Hart County police and court systems are grateful. But the reason Marty said that I sparred with him with the money, and I think I have some friends sitting in the second row that will attest to it, and if my mother was here, she would really attest to it. I'm frugal. My mother has a word for it. She says it's cheap. Frugal sounds better to me. And that's the way I work my program as I bounce back in and out of this program, is I would look for words that suited me. I wasn't a drunk. I just drank a little too much. You know, I wasn't mean. I was just misunderstood. You know, so I'd find words that would suit my fancy. And when I would come in here, you know, I said June 28th, 2004 was my sobriety date. The first time I come into AA was in 86. And so there's a lot of time in between my first introduction here and when it finally sunk in for me, or when I was finally willing to do what was suggested. And I hope to spend a little bit of time on my childhood, tell you a little bit about my parents and brothers, because they were very important to me and they still are today. And I put them through a lot, though at the time I didn't realize it. Spend a little bit of time on my little escapades from 86 to 2004, because that'll really explain step two of the insanity that this disease does. Because I never thought I was insane, because I never went to the nut wards, or, you know, someone had to explain to me when the cops put your hands behind your back, that's just as like going to the, you know, the loony place. So I had to realize that. And then I hope to spend a lot more time on my sobriety, because I love my sobriety today. I love what it's given me today. But I don't know what's going to happen, so let's wing it from there. I was born in a little town in Ohio, about 50 miles north of Steubenville, Ohio. Now, in Steubenville, Ohio, there is an actor-singer who I admired when I was growing up, and those of you with gray hair like mine will remember who it was. It's Dean Martin. And Dean Martin used to have a TV show. And on his TV show, he would have a cigarette in one hand, a drink in another hand, and two women on each arm. And I said, that's what I want to be. Now, 50 miles north of me, there's a little town of Akron, Ohio. And in Akron, Ohio, there was this doctor. They called him Dr. Bob, and I never knew who Dr. Bob was. Had no reason to know who Dr. Bob was, because I had nothing in common with Dr. Bob. I come down to Florida, and I realized that I had more in common with Dr. Bob than I did with Dean Martin. Backtrack on my parents here. I'll tell you a little story. I was talking to my dad the other day, and my brother named his son after me. So there's two Doug Botovs in the world. And so my nephew's gone to college up in Akron. And my dad went up there to visit him and went to the refrigerator and saw a six-pack of beer in his refrigerator. And there was only four left in there. So my dad, knowing my history, went to my nephew and said, what's that in your refrigerator? My nephew said, well, 2 weeks ago, I went to the store and I bought a six-pack of beer. My dad said, oh, okay. So he talked to me, and he said, well, what do you think of that, Doug? And I said, you know, that's terrible. And he said, terrible? And I said, yeah. I said, there is no way that a refrigerator should get four beers and an individual should only get two. And he said, have you ever had, how long has a six-pack lasted in your refrigerator? And I said, not even 2 hours. So that's the way my family drinks, and you're going to hear about how I drink. My brother, when he first got... Well, let me tell you about my resentments. I never knew what a resentment was when I come in here. I thought it was something that you hated, you know, something that you just despised. But as I worked through the program, I realized that I had a resentment before I was even born. When I was born in 58, a little younger than Angel. I had a sister. She was born in 1952. She was born, and she had went into the hospital for a tonsillectomy, and she also had a mole on her back. So while they had her in the hospital, they wanted to take the mole off. So she was in the hospital. She died on the operating table. So before I was born, I had a sister. Now, in my mind, I didn't have a sister. But as I was growing up, they said I had a sister. So as I was growing up, we'd see pictures of her in her tap dancing shoes because she's a tap dancer. And there'd be pictures of my sister in her tap dancing shoes, me in my kindergarten picture, my brother in a second grade picture. And it just kept on going as we would grow. They'd always keep her picture in the tap dancing and just move our pictures up. And it was one of those things that my parents always said, you know, if you have any questions you want, you know, don't take, you know, answers. You know, if you have questions, ask. But that was one question that I was just terrified to ask. You know, what happened to my sister? But I always kept that deep down inside of me. You know, why does it seem not to affect my parents or my brother, but it affects me? You know. You know, they already had their grieving process, but see, I didn't. So that was my first resentment. And as I was got up through school, I got into the second grade, and I was held back. And again, why am I being held back? You know, it was, you know, they said, well, you needed glasses. So I ended up glasses. Now, I know I'm a very handsome guy today, but when I was in second grade, you know, my teeth weren't very straight as they are today, and you put a pair of glasses on me. There was a show, My Three Sons, and the youngest son, Ernie. I have pictures that I tell you I look exactly like Ernie. I hate Ernie. Another resentment. But before I go on too long, I meant to tell you about step 10. Continue to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. Central is my home group. So the people that are in this room were very instrumental in helping me get sober. I will mention names occasionally, as you've already heard. I hope not to, because I don't want to embarrass people. But there are things that you've done and said in these rooms that has been very instrumental to me and helped me. So if you think that it's you that I'm talking about, come up to me afterwards and I'll say yes or no, it wasn't. And if you wish that I said your name, I'll get you the little reading on humility here and we can read that. My drinking started when I was in high school. I wasn't one of these young ones. I started when I was about 17. My parents went to pick my brother up from college, and I wanted to get drunk. My friends and I wanted to get drunk. So we said, well, my parents are leaving. We'll drink at the house. We'll get drunk, and we'll be in a safe place. And I knew my parents would be home about midnight, so they said, if you really want to get drunk, the best thing to drink is Mad Dog 2020. Now, my parents owned a liquor store, and you would have thought that with them owning a liquor store that I would know better drinks to get than Mad Dog 2020. But I took my friend's advice and got Mad Dog 2020. So my way of drinking is I get a soda, I drink the whole soda. I get a water, I drink the whole water. I had a bottle of Mad Dog. I attempted to drink the whole bottle of Mad Dog. I don't know if I did or didn't. I always claimed that I never had blackouts, but you don't remember it, and you must have had a blackout. The only thing I remember is my friends dropping me off at home. You know, we were sitting at the house, and one of my friends said, "We got to get him out of the house. He's going to get sick." So we left the house. We got back later that night, way past the time my parents got home. And my mom and dad, brother was standing there, and my mom looks at me, "Where you been?" So I was running around town here. "Oh, okay. You got your dad's shoes on." "Well, they fit." My dad wears two sizes bigger than I do, but they fit me that night. My dad looked at me. My brother looked at me, said, "Let's get them out of here." So we went and had coffee, and they knew what was going on. My mother didn't. And the progression of this disease is my mother saw me the first time that I was drunk, didn't know it at all. It went from that point to the point where I would call her on the telephone, and it could be a mere, "Hello, Mom, how you doing?" And she would be able to say, "You're drunk again, Doug." You know, that's what the progression of alcohol does to me. So I got through high school, went to college for a year. As I like to say, it was the best party my parents ever threw for me. After that, I knew I couldn't stay in that little town in Ohio. You know, I was a big fish in a small pond. You know, so let me out of here. Where can I go? And I always enjoyed the beach. When we'd go on summer vacations, we'd always go to Cape Hatteras. And I said, if North Carolina is good, Florida has to be better. So I moved down to Florida, knowing nobody, just coming down. And at the time, if you'd have said, "Doug, are you running away from anything?" I would have said, "No. Jobs are getting scarce up in Ohio. I'm just coming down here to, you know, get away from what's bound to happen. You know, the steel mills are closing down. So let's get down here where the jobs are." But in reality, what it is I was running away. I knew that it was getting too hot up there. No matter how cold the winters were, it was getting hot for me. So I moved down to Florida, and I got a job right away. And I'm still working at that same job. 30 years at the same job. And I'm going to tell you what's happened between those 30 years, and you're going to say, "How did he keep that job?" And I'm going to tell you, it had nothing to do with me. It had to do with God. I would have told you before all the great stuff that I did, how the company wouldn't have been able to survive without me. But in reality, it was by the grace of God. It was only God that kept me at this job for as long as it is. So I come down here and started working. And I like to say that I was working that ladder of success. But the way it really happened, because someone told me I got to tell the truth. What happened is that when I started there, I was the very new guy. Within a month, everybody quit but me. So I was now the head guy. So my ladder of success was get rid of everybody above you, and you're there. So, and the president of the company, for whatever reason, did like me. And, you know, I wasn't in the depths of my alcoholism at the time. But I was drinking, but I didn't have any money. So as cheap as I am, I couldn't drink unless you were buying. And so as I was trudging my way to happy destiny through my job, you know, and started drinking a little bit more, all of a sudden, you know, the company wasn't, you know, enjoying the hard work I was doing. And I needed some relief. And I knew how to get relief because I got the relief when I was up in Ohio. And that's by having a few drinks. A few drinks that I've seen other people take. You know, a few drinks I'd seen my dad do. have a couple drinks. He may even leave half of his beer. So I would go and out and have a few drinks. Now, if you'd have asked me at any time, even when I come in here this last time, Doug, when did you drink? What was your drinking habits? I would have told you I'm a weekend drinker. Just drink on the weekends. Here's my weekend. Friday, I'd come home from work, stop off at the bar. Whoop, wait a minute. Friday's not the weekend. The weekend's Saturday and Sunday. Well, Friday's part of the weekend. That's leading into it. So, of course, Saturday and Sunday I'm allowed to drink because that's my weekend. Monday night football. Come on. You know, you got to drink on Monday night football. You know, and then if Monday night football's there, got basketball, and you're in the habit anyway, so you might as well continue the drinking. Tuesday would come. You know, I'd want to stop off and have some wings. You know, how can you have wings without having a couple beers? You know? So Tuesday I'm drinking. You know, Wednesday, hump night, everybody drinks on hump night. So drank on hump night. Thursday, woman's night. Gotta go out. Huh? You know, I'm gonna be there. Huh? My head may be on the bar, but I'm going to be there. So then I'm back to Friday. So my weekend drinking turned into a week of drinking. I had to find that honesty through the program, too. Then the consequences started, and we're going to pass through those real quick. Because it's not how many times I got pulled over for drunk driving. It's what I was thinking every time it happened. DUI number one. Everybody gets one DUI. Everybody. If I would take a pull here, I know everybody's hand would go up. I found out that not everybody in Alcoholics Anonymous had a DUI. My parents never had a DUI. My brother never had a DUI. I have cousins who've never had a DUI. But when I had my first one, everybody had one. DUI number two, you know, things happen. You know? Things happen. Yeah. But I knew what I had to do. My father was always a hard worker. So what I needed to do is I needed to get a part-time job. Keep me busy. I didn't have enough things keeping me going. So if I'd stay busy, I'd be okay. Now, the bad thing about that is I had a resentment against one company. I got a part-time job. That gave me another resentment against another company because they didn't know how to run their company either. You know? So went out DUI number three. I know what to do after you get DUI number three. You need a relationship. You know, yeah. A lot of women want a man that has three DUIs. Yeah. So I thought. So that worked so well for me, I got another one, DUI number four. Now, at this time, all these DUIs, one through three, nobody knew about. My job didn't know about it. My parents didn't know about it. I would come in here because I was forced to by those judges. And you'd say, what are you here for? Here for a DUI. Well, why don't you get a sponsor? Get a big book and work those steps. I'll get right on it as soon as I get this big list of things that the court wants me to do. Once I get those done, maybe I'll look at this. That sponsor stuff, we'll hold off on that for a while. So, you know, I got my, what DUI am I on? I start getting confused. I'm on four. That's what sponsors are for, you know, to keep this stuff straight. So on DUI 4, I had to call my parents to bail me out. My friend quit bailing me out of jail. So now my parents knew what was going on. So they come down here. My mom flew down here, bailed me out of jail. And she said, "Don't worry, Doug. Everything's going to be okay. We'll get through this." And there's nothing like having to tell your mom that, you know what? This isn't the first time. This is the fourth time. And as funny as it is now, at that time, to see the look on my mother's face, it was horrendous. If that wouldn't have you quit drinking, nothing will. So I got DUI number 5. And this time was over at Cocoa Beach. I'd always have this dream over at Cocoa. I'd be going over that bridge, 528 bridge. And as I'd be going over that bridge, for some reason, it's a dream, for some reason, there'd be a cop following me. And then I'd be going over the bridge and right over it, right into the water. And then you wake up, it's a dream. But that was a dream I've had for years. And I was coming home from the beach, and I was right at the bottom of 528, or I was going over 528, and there was a wreck. And you know how when there's a wreck, you know, you kind of get nosy. You need to see what's going on there. Well, I happened to look over there, and when I looked back on the road, this cop out of nowhere jumped right out in front of me. I swear he jumped right out in front of me. Well, you know, so I swerved off and moved. He didn't jump out in front of me. He was there directing traffic. So I get down at the bottom of the bridge, and another cop's there, you know, waving me by and say, "You know, you almost hit that cop." And, of course, I told him my side of the story. And he said, "Well, let's get out and do a sobriety test." So I was introduced to the Brevard County Jail. And, again, who am I going to call but my mother? And she had a hard enough time finding Orange County Jail, and I didn't even know where Brevard County Jail was. But they found me. They come and got me. And when your mom tells you you're an alcoholic, you're an alcoholic. So maybe there's time to do something. So I come into these rooms. You told me the exact same things that you always did. Get a sponsor. Work the steps. I said, "Okay, but you don't understand. My situation is different. I got this big, long list that I have to do for the judges. I don't have a car to get back and forth. How am I going to do all this stuff that you want me to do?" You know, and they'll only pester you so long. And once they see that you're not willing, as the big book says, go to the next one. You know, and they could see that I wasn't willing. And I wasn't willing. I just wanted the consequences to go. And every time the consequences would go, I would get a little bit of relief. And I'd say, I'm okay now. And then somebody said something to me in the rooms here. And they said, "Would you rather have relief or would you rather have recovery?" I thought, I want relief. You know, I want relief. Then they explained to me, the best way to get relief that will last is take care of the recovery first, and then the relief will come. They said, get a sponsor, do these 12 steps, and all that stuff that the court wants, just set it aside for a few minutes, you know, and then go back to that. But get a sponsor and do these steps. I said, you don't understand. If I don't do this, they're going to throw me in jail, and I cannot go to jail. So I did what the courts wanted. I was getting ready to come in here and get a sponsor and do these things. And then I said, I need to take a little break. I deserve it after doing all that. And then something happened at work. They upset me. And I said, what should I do? What do I do when people upset me? I think I'll go and drink and ponder this over. I'll come up with some good ideas. And all I wanted was one or two drinks. And that's all I had. And I pondered the situation and took care of it. But you know what? I went home the next day from work and I said, you know what? I had one or two drinks that day. why don't I stop again? And I had three or four. Next thing I know, they're waking me up and saying, Doug, we're closing the bar. Next thing you know, I'm over Cocoa Beach again. I'm at the bottom of that bridge. I see some lights coming. I know they're not after the guy in front of me. And this thought went through my mind. Gun it. Put your foot on the gas and go. Next thing I know, my car's pulling over. Back in jail. That was June 28th, 2004. My mom come back down again. You know, what can you say to a mother, a father that's, you know, you put them through that? I just sat at home, you know, pondering what I had to do, called the lawyer, you know, said, do anything you can. I just don't want to go to jail. So I'm sitting there at home listening to my mom bitching, yelling, screaming, just telling me how, you know, these are her retirement years and what am I doing to them? And I'm just there, you know, between, you know, saying, yes, I know, you know, I feel bad, and thinking, why don't you just leave me alone, you know? And I was in counseling at the time, and I was telling my counselor this, and she said, you know, she doesn't have to be there. All you have to do is say, Mom, why don't you go home? Well, I can't do that. How will I get back and forth to work? You know, it was all about me. All about me. And she said, go to a meeting. Go to a meeting. So I went to a meeting. I started going, coming back to Alcoholics Anonymous because of the courts, because of my counselors. And there was a bunch of people in that meeting. Over here in the corner, there was an old guy, Reese McCain. Reese McCain was the calmest, most sweetest guy I've ever met. You know, he was the voice of peace. Then there was another guy here named Roy Brooks. Now, Reese always sat there in that corner. It was very rare that you'd see him not sitting there. Roy Brooks, it seemed like with Roy, he would look for somebody that was in pain, and he would go and sit with them. You know, and it didn't matter who it was, because he sat next to me a couple times. He knew I was in pain. And I always thought, if I could sit between Roy and Reese, and at the end of the meeting, when we're doing the Lord's Prayer, if I could just have both of those guys holding my hand, saying, it works if you work it. I just know I will get this. And Vicki isn't here, I don't think. But Vicki was sitting over there one time, and she called Roy over. She wanted to talk to Roy. And I was sitting next to Reese, and it was magic. Magic of God working in my life again, that I had Reese and Roy sitting next to me. And at the end of the meeting, we were there holding hands. You know what? It was great power, but, you know, after it was over, I went my way, and they went theirs. I didn't drink, but it wasn't what I expected. I wanted the quick fix, and I never could get it. So I was looking for a sponsor. There was another guy called Gator Bob, and I like Gator Bob because he always had a smile on his face and he'd have a good time. He was having a good time in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I thought, you know, I'm going to ask Bob to be my sponsor. So I went over to him and I'd sit with him a lot. And I went over there and sat with him, and Bob says, I got some news. And I thought his news was going to be that he was a Buckeye fan. You know, because I'm from Ohio. Yeah, because Buckeye Bob would sound a hell of a lot better than Gator Bob. You know. But his news is that he just got a job promotion and he was moving to South Florida. My chance of getting a sponsor went out. Well, you know what? During these meetings, they're always talking about God's will. Maybe God's will is for me not to have a sponsor. Well, that wasn't it. I ended up getting a sponsor, and I moved down to South Florida here not too long ago, but we still keep in touch, and he comes back on anniversaries. And it's he took me through the steps. And being that this is anniversary night, I do want to end it quick. But he took me through the steps. First step, I had a heck of a time, before. You know, powerless over alcohol. I could not understand how a little piece of alcohol could affect a person. And I fought that forever, fought it. The unmanageability. How can a person be unmanageable that's had a job for same job for 30 years, worked for the same company? How can he be unmanageable? I had a home. I had a car. Didn't always have the license to go with the car, but I had a car. Then we went to the third step. What happened was that with the unmanageability, they explained to me about... if you go to a bar and you say you're going to have two drinks and you end up having 20, there's some unmanageability problems there. If you tell somebody you're going to pick them up at 8 o'clock for a date and you don't pick them up at all, there's some unmanageability. They should understand, I did call them the next day, but that's unmanageability. Step two, the insanity. I wasn't insane. I already told you that. I was, I did not get in a straitjacket. I was in jail with people that were in those little straitjackets. That was not me. Somebody gave me the definition of an insanity, doing the same thing over and over again. I would say 6 DUI arrests qualify as doing the same thing over and over again. So I was insane. Then they said that there was an answer to that, to make a decision to turn my will and life over to the care of God as we understood him. Now, they told me I could pick my own God, but it says up there, as we understood him. I had to come into the rooms and listen to your concept of God for me to get my concept of God. Because my concept of God was the God that took my little sister away, or my older sister away. That was the God I grew up with. How could a God... a loving God, as people would say. Take a little 5-year-old child, And I had to realize that wasn't God. That was part of life. If it wasn't her, it'd be somebody else. Fourth step. My sponsor always loves my fourth step. I'll tell you how not to do a fourth step. You get one of these pads. I didn't have a cell phone when I come in. I don't even know. I was too cheap. Frugal to get a cell phone. But I always had a pad for numbers. A pad is good for phone numbers. Do not go to your sponsor, and when he says, "Do you have your fourth step?" and you say, "Yes, I do," and he says, "Show it to me," and hand them it. It does not qualify for a fourth step like it is in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. So he told me to go back to the Big Book. Do it as it is in the book. So I did it. I did it to the best of my ability at that time. Then we went and did a fifth step. Fifth step, I did not tell him my story. We shared both of our stories. And to me, that was very important. Because I don't know what I would have told him if I was just going to have to tell him the bad things I've done. The bad son I was. The bad brother I was. The bad person I was. But as I would tell him things, and he would tell me things, it would open me up to tell me a little bit more. And then he'd tell me a little bit more. I felt more comfortable to do a little bit more. And then we got through it. And, big book says, you know, we get that feeling of freedom. I didn't get that feeling. I just got a feeling of, I'm glad it's over. You know? I'll wait and see what happens now. 6 and 7. We love 6 and 7. 6 and 7 isn't very big in the big book, but they explain it very well in the 12 and 12. You know, our defects of character. And what is my defect of character, Ed? What's the one that we always talk about?
Sarcasm.
Yeah, sarcasm. Sarcasm I always used as a defense mechanism, and I still use sarcasm as a defense mechanism. Now, sarcasm isn't bad. I spoke one time, and I believe it was here, and I said sarcasm. Somebody hollered out, there's nothing wrong with that. And it isn't. I have friends in here tonight that we use sarcasm with each other. But, you know, we use it in a kind and loving manner, and we laugh about it. We smile about it. I'm a gray-haired old man. That's the sarcasm they use for me. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's the truth.
Well. I got yours later. Yeah. My friend Tommy. And if you didn't hear him, he said that's the truth. But I would use sarcasm to put people down so I could feel higher. And that's a bad form of sarcasm. If you use it like we do in here most of the time. Be happy, joyous, and free. That's great. Then I had to do my amends. And I wanted to run and tell my parents right then. My sponsor said, woo. What are you going to say to them? You're sorry? They've heard sorry enough. So he said, take care of your other amends. We'll get back to your parents. So a couple years ago, my father called, said he was going to have hip replacement. And said, I'm telling you because I want you to know, nothing to worry about, no big deal. I said, okay. So I called my sponsor. I said, I think I'm going to surprise my parents and go up for my dad's operation. He said, good, it's about time you do something good for him. He said, when you go up there, be open for new experiences. You think you're going up there for your father, but be open for whatever can possibly happen. Okay. No, I can do that. So I go up there, and first of all, they're very surprised seeing me because it was in the midst of winter, and I said, I will never come up to Ohio in the winter. And so I'm through the operation. And it was supposed to be a 2-hour operation, ended up being 4 hours. And my mom was a wreck. My brother was a wreck. And I was somewhat calm. I don't know why, but, you know, I was just, you know, there for support. And he got through it, and they said, you guys can go out and eat, because it'll be an hour till we can see people. We'll be out of recovery. So we said, okay, we'll go and get a bite to eat. So we're walking out of the hospital, and I'm walking with my mom. My brother's a little bit ahead of us, and she's holding on to my arm, and she says, Doug, I don't want to go. And I said, well, why not? It's going to be an hour or so until he's out. He said, when your sister was in the hospital, they told us we could go get a bite to eat. We went and got a bite to eat, and while we were out eating, that's when she passed away. I said, okay, we won't go. So I told my brother, I said, we're not going to go eat. Mom and I are just going to go to the cafeteria. I said, if you want to eat, that's fine. My brother wanted to leave. And I always wondered, why would my mom ask me, tell me that? My brother's older, more responsible. But she came to me with that information. And it had nothing to do with me. It had to do with the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and the God that I found through Alcoholics Anonymous. And that was the only reason. A couple years ago, my parents come down every winter. They haven't come down these last few. They're getting older, not able to come down. But my dad was going to come down for a week, then my mom was going to come down for a week, and then my dad was going to drive down. And my dad was down here, and he got a phone call from my mom. She went to the doctor, found out she had cancer. So my dad says, I'm going home. I got a flight. I'm leaving. So I do what all good AA people do. I called my friends in the room. And I said, my dad's going to have to rush home to see my mom because she has cancer. And why don't we get together and have dinner before he goes? Now, usually it's no big deal. But I had one friend that was taking the law exam that was studying real hard for that. I had another friend that had a date. I had another friend that had some big business meetings going on. And I had another friend that had just started a new job and had to be sure that he was there early in the morning. So all four things going on with these guys. Now, if that was me and I had any one of those things, especially the date, I would have said, sorry, I'll see you later. But these people dropped everything that they had going on in their life, not to be with me, to be with my father and to comfort him. That, to me, is what Alcoholics Anonymous is. It's not just about us. It's about our family. We come in here and we become families of ourselves here, but we also become families of our families. And to me, that's powerful. And that's powerful. We got there at the restaurant. We called my mom. Everybody talked to her, wished her well, said it'll be okay. Our prayers are with you. I come into these rooms, let people know what was going on. They said, our prayers are with her. Your prayers were with my father when he went through his. She's in remission. She's in remission. Now my dad has a little ticker problem going on, but he's okay with it. He's at peace. I'm at peace. And before I leave, I want to read this little story, the football story. Not a Pittsburgh Steeler football story. But I like listening to AA tapes. And I heard this. It's from Diz T. He's from North Florida. Alcoholics Anonymous is going to have a football team, and you're going to be the quarterback. We're going to give you two ends named patience and tolerance. We're going to give you two tackles named honesty and humility. They can block anybody. We're going to give you two guards named unselfishness and gratitude. The center's name is willingness. We suggest you use willingness on every play. The running backs are belief and faith. You can hand the ball off to either one of them. Your wide receiver is going to be courage. You can throw to him if you want to. God is going to be the only official. The ground rules are going to be the 12 steps. The football is your eternal soul, and the goalposts are the gates to heaven. Now get out there and play ball. Thank you very much.